Chapter 84. Night had fallen on the ancient Byzantine capital. All along the banks of the Sea of Marmara, floodlights flickered to life, illuminating a skyline of glistening mosques and slender minarets. This was the hour of the Akşam, and loudspeakers across the city reverberated with the haunting intonations of the azan, the call to prayer. La ilaha illallah. There is no God but the God. While the faithful scurried to mosques, the rest of the city carried on without a glance. Raucous university students drank beer, businessmen closed deals, merchants hawked spices and rugs, and tourists watched it all in wonder. This was a world divided, a city of opposing forces, religious, secular, ancient, modern, Eastern, Western. Straddling the geographic boundary between Europe and Asia, this timeless city was quite literally the bridge from the old world to a world that was even older, Istanbul. While no longer the capital of Turkey, it had served over the centuries as the epicenter of three distinct empires, the Byzantine, the Roman, and the Ottoman. For this reason, Istanbul was arguably one of the most historically diverse locations on Earth. From Topkapi Palace, to the Blue Mosque, to the Castle of the Seven Towers, the city is teeming with folkloric tales of battle, glory, and defeat. Tonight, high in the night sky above its bustling masses, a C-130 transport plane was descending through a gathering storm front on final approach to Ataturk Airport. Inside the cockpit, buckled into the jump seat behind the pilots, Robert Langdon peered out through the windshield, relieved that he had been offered a seat with a view. He was feeling somewhat refreshed after having had something to eat, and then dozing at the rear of the plane for nearly an hour of much-needed rest. Now, off to his right, Langdon could see the lights of Istanbul, a glistening, horn-shaped peninsula jutting into the blackness of the Sea of Marmara. This was the European side, separated from its Asian sister by a sinuous ribbon of darkness, the Bosporus waterway. At a glance, the Bosporus appeared as a wide gash that severed Istanbul in two. In fact, Langdon knew the channel was the lifeblood of Istanbul's commerce. In addition to providing the city with two coastlines rather than one, the Bosporus enabled ship passage from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea, allowing Istanbul to serve as a way station between two worlds. As the plane descended through a layer of mist, Langdon's eyes intently scanned the distant city, trying to catch a glimpse of the massive building they had come to search. The site of Enrico Dandolo's tomb. As it turned out, Enrico Dandolo, the treacherous Doge of Venice, had not been buried in Venice. Rather, his remains had been interred in the heart of the stronghold he had conquered in 1202, the sprawling city beneath them. Fittingly, Dandolo had been laid to rest in the most spectacular shrine his captured city had to offer, a building that to this day remained the crown jewel of the region, Hagia Sophia. Originally built in AD 360, Hagia Sophia had served as an Eastern Orthodox cathedral until 1204, when Enrico Dandolo and the Fourth Crusade conquered the city and turned it into a Catholic church. Later, in the 15th century, following the conquest of Constantinople by Fatih Sultan Mehmed, it had become a mosque, remaining an Islamic house of worship until 1935, when the building was secularized and became a museum. A gilded Museon of holy wisdom, Langdon thought. Not only was Hagia Sophia adorned with more gold tile than St. Mark's, its name, Hagia Sophia, literally meant holy wisdom. Langdon pictured the colossal building and tried to fathom the fact that somewhere beneath it, a darkened lagoon contained a tethered, undulating sack, hovering underwater, slowly dissolving and preparing to release its contents. Langdon prayed they were not too late.
The building's lower levels are flooded, Sinsky had announced earlier in the flight, excitedly motioning for Langdon to follow her back to her work area. You won't believe what we just discovered. Have you ever heard of a documentary film director named Göksel Gülensoy?
Langdon shook his head.
While I was researching Hagia Sophia, Sinsky explained, I discovered that a film had been made about it, a documentary made by Gülensoy a few years back.
Dozens of films have been made about Hagia Sophia.
Yes, she said, arriving at her work area, but none like this.
She spun her laptop so he could see it.
Read this.
Langdon sat down and eyed the article, a composite of various news sources, including the Hurriyet Daily News, discussing Gülensoy's newest film, In the Depths of Hagia Sophia. As Langdon began to read, he immediately realized why Sinsky was excited. The first two words alone made Langdon glance up at her in surprise. Scuba diving?
I know, she said. Just read.
Langdon turned his eyes back to the article. Scuba diving beneath Hagia Sophia. Documentary filmmaker Göksel Gülensoy and his exploratory scuba team have located remote flooded basins lying hundreds of feet beneath Istanbul's heavily touristed religious structure. In the process, they discovered numerous architectural wonders, including the 800-year-old submerged graves of martyred children, as well as submerged tunnels connecting Hagia Sophia to Topkapi Palace, Tekfur Palace, and the rumored subterranean extensions of the Anemis dungeons. I believe what is beneath Hagia Sophia is much more exciting than what is above the surface, Gülensoy explained, describing how he had been inspired to make the film after seeing an old photograph of researchers examining the foundations of Hagia Sophia by boat, paddling through a large, partially submerged hall.
You've obviously found the right building, Sinsky exclaimed, and it sounds like there are huge pockets of navigable space beneath that building, many of them accessible without scuba gear, which may also explain what we're seeing in Zobrist's video.
Agent Bruder stood behind them, studying the laptop screen. It also sounds like the waterways beneath the building spider outward to all kinds of other areas. If that Solublon bag dissolves before we arrive, there will be no way to stop the contents from spreading. The contents, Langdon ventured. Do you have any idea what it is? I mean, exactly? I know we're dealing with a pathogen, but
we've been analyzing the footage, Bruder said, which suggests that it's indeed biological rather than chemical. That is to say, something living. Considering the small amount in the bag, we assume it's highly contagious and has the ability to replicate. Whether it's a waterborne contagion like a bacterium, or whether it has the potential to go airborne like a virus once it's released, we are not sure. But either is possible.
Sinsky said,
We're now gathering data on water table temperatures in the area, trying to assess what kinds of contagious substances might thrive in those subterranean areas. But Zobrist was exceptionally talented and easily could have engineered something with unique capabilities. And I have to suspect that there was a reason Zobrist chose this location.
Bruder gave a resigned nod and quickly relayed his assessment of the unusual dispersal mechanism, the submerged Solublon bag, the simple brilliance of which was just starting to dawn on them all. By suspending the bag underground and underwater, Zobrist had created an exceptionally stable incubation environment, one with consistent water temperature, no solar radiation, a kinetic buffer, and total privacy. By choosing a bag of the correct durability, Zobrist could leave the contagion unattended to mature for a specific duration before it self-released on schedule, even if Zobrist never returned to the site. The sudden jolt of the plane touching down jarred Langdon back to his jump seat in the cockpit. The pilots braked hard and then taxied to a remote hangar where they brought the massive plane to a stop. Langdon half expected to be greeted by an army of WHO employees in hazmat suits. Strangely, the only party awaiting their arrival was the driver of a large white van that bore the emblem of a bright, red, equal-armed cross. The Red Cross is here? Langdon looked again, realizing it was the other entity that used the Red Cross, the Swiss Embassy.
He unbuckled and located Sinsky as everyone prepared to deplane.
"Where is everyone?" Langdon demanded. "The WHO team? The Turkish authorities? Is everyone already over at Hagia Sophia?"
Sinsky gave him an uneasy glance.
"Actually," she explained, "we have decided against alerting local authorities. We already have the ECDC's finest SRS team with us, and it seems preferable to keep this a quiet operation for the moment, rather than creating a possible widespread panic."
Nearby, Langdon could see Bruder and his team zipping up large black duffel bags that contained all kinds of hazmat gear, biosuits, respirators, and electronic detection equipment. Bruder heaved his bag over his shoulder and came over.
"We're a go. We'll enter the building, find Dandolo's tomb, listen for water as the poem suggests, and then my team and I will reassess and decide whether to call in other authorities for support."
Langdon already saw problems with the plan. "Hagia Sophia closes at sunset, so without local authorities, we can't even get in."
"We're fine," Sinsky said. "I have a contact in the Swiss embassy who contacted the Hagia Sophia Museum curator and asked for a private VIP tour as soon as we arrive. The curator agreed."
Langdon almost laughed out loud. "A VIP tour for the director of the World Health Organization and an army of soldiers carrying hazmat duffels? You don't think that might raise a few eyebrows?"
"The SRS team and gear will stay in the car, while Bruder, you, and I assess the situation," Sinsky said. "Also, for the record, I'm not the VIP. You are."
"I beg your pardon?"
"We told the museum that a famous American professor had flown in with a research team to write an article on the symbols of Hagia Sophia, but their plane was delayed 5 hours, and he missed his window to see the building. Since he and his team were leaving tomorrow morning, we were hoping..."
"Okay," Langdon said. "I get the gist."
"The museum is sending an employee to meet us there personally. As it turns out, he's a big fan of your writings on Islamic art."
Sinsky gave him a tired smile, clearly trying to look optimistic.
"We've been assured that you'll have access to every corner of the building."
"And more important," Bruder declared, "we'll have the entire place to ourselves."
Chapter 85. Robert Langdon gazed blankly out the window of the van as it sped along the waterfront highway connecting Ataturk Airport to the center of Istanbul. The Swiss officials had somehow facilitated a modified customs process, and Langdon, Sinsky, and the others in the group had been en route in a matter of minutes. Sinsky had ordered the provost and Ferris to remain aboard the C-130 with several WHO staff members and to continue trying to track the whereabouts of Sienna Brooks. While nobody truly believed Sienna could reach Istanbul in time, there were fears she might phone one of Zobrist's disciples in Turkey and ask for assistance in realizing Zobrist's delusional plan before Sinsky's team could interfere. Would Sienna really commit mass murder? Langdon was still struggling to accept all that had happened today. It pained him to do so, but he was forced to accept the truth. "You never knew her, Robert. She played you." A light rain had begun to fall over the city, and Langdon felt suddenly weary as he listened to the repetitive swish of the windshield wipers. To his right, out on the Sea of Marmara, he could see the running lights of luxury yachts and massive tankers powering to and from the city port up ahead. All along the waterfront, illuminated minarets rose slender and elegant above their domed mosques, silent reminders that while Istanbul was a modern secular city, its core was grounded in religion. Langdon had always found this 10-mile strip of highway one of the prettiest drives in Europe. A perfect example of Istanbul's clash of old and new, the road followed part of Constantine's Wall, which had been built more than 16 centuries before the birth of the man for whom this avenue was now named, John F. Kennedy. The U.S. president had been a great admirer of Kemal Atatürk's vision for a Turkish republic springing from the ashes of a fallen empire. Providing unparalleled views of the sea, Kennedy Avenue wound through spectacular groves and historic parks, past the harbor in Yenikapi and eventually threaded its way between the city limits and the Strait of Bosporus, where it continued northward all the way around the Golden Horn. There, high above the city, rose the Ottoman stronghold of Topkapi Palace. With its strategic view of the Bosporus waterway, the palace was a favorite among tourists, who visited to admire both the vistas and the staggering collection of Ottoman treasure that included the cloak and sword said to have belonged to the Prophet Muhammad himself. "We won't be going that far," Langdon knew, picturing their destination, Hagia Sophia, which rose out of the city center not far ahead. As they pulled off Kennedy Avenue and began snaking into the densely populated city, Langdon stared out at the crowds of people on the streets and sidewalks and felt haunted by the day's conversations. Overpopulation, the plague, Zobrist's twisted aspirations. Even though Langdon had understood all along exactly where this SRS mission was headed, he had not fully processed it until this moment. "We are going to ground zero." He pictured the slowly dissolving bag of yellow-brown fluid and wondered how he had let himself get into this position. The strange poem that Langdon and Sienna had unveiled on the back of Dante's death mask had eventually guided him here, to Istanbul. Langdon had directed the SRS team to Hagia Sophia and knew there would be more to do once they arrived. "Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here, in the darkness, the Thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars." Langdon again felt troubled to know that the final canto of Dante's Inferno ended in a nearly identical scene. After a long descent through the underworld, Dante and Virgil reach the lowest point of hell. Here, with no way out, they hear the sounds of trickling water running through stones beneath them, and they follow the rivulet through cracks and crevices, ultimately finding safety. Dante wrote, "A place is there below, which not by sight is known, but by the sound of a rivulet, which descends along the hollow of a rock. And by that hidden way, my guide and I did enter, to return to the fair world." Dante's scene had clearly been the inspiration for Zobrist's poem, although in this case, it seemed Zobrist had flipped everything upside down. Langdon and the others would indeed be following the sounds of trickling water. But unlike Dante, they would not be heading away from the inferno, but directly into it. As the van maneuvered through tighter streets and more densely populated neighborhoods, Langdon began to grasp the perverse logic that had led Zobrist to choose downtown Istanbul as the epicenter of a pandemic. East meets West, the crossroads of the world. Istanbul had, at numerous times in history, succumbed to deadly plagues that killed off enormous portions of its population. In fact, during the final phase of the Black Death, this very city had been called the plague hub of the empire, and the disease was said to have killed more than 10,000 residents a day. Several famous Ottoman paintings depicted townspeople desperately digging plague pits to bury mounds of corpses in the nearby fields of Taksim. Langdon hoped Karl Marx was wrong when he said, "History repeats itself." All along the rainy streets, unsuspecting souls were bustling about their evening's business. A pretty Turkish woman called her children in to dinner. Two old men shared a drink at an outdoor cafe. A well-dressed couple walked hand in hand beneath an umbrella, and a tuxedoed man leaped off a bus and ran down the street, sheltering his violin case beneath his jacket, apparently late for a concert. Langdon found himself studying the faces around him, trying to imagine the intricacies of each person's life. "The masses are made up of individuals." He closed his eyes, turning from the window and trying to abandon the morbid turn his thoughts had taken. But the damage was done. In the darkness of his mind, an unwanted image materialized. The desolate landscape of Bruegel's Triumph of Death, a hideous panorama of pestilence, misery, and torture, laying ruin to a seaside city. The van turned to the right onto Torun Avenue, and for a moment Langdon thought they had arrived at their destination. On his left, rising out of the mist, a great mosque appeared. But it was not Hagia Sophia. The Blue Mosque, he quickly realized, spotting the building's six fluted, pencil-shaped minarets, which had multiple sherefe balconies and climbed skyward to end in piercing spires. Langdon had once read that the exotic, fairy-tale quality of the Blue Mosque's balconied minarets had inspired the design for Cinderella's iconic castle at Disney World. The Blue Mosque drew its name from the dazzling sea of blue tiles that adorned its interior walls. We're close, Langdon thought, as the van sped onward, turning on to Gabasakal Avenue and running along the expansive plaza of Sultan Ahmet Park, which was situated halfway between the Blue Mosque and Hagia Sophia, and famous for its views of both. Langdon squinted through the rain-swept windshield, searching the horizon for the outline of Hagia Sophia, but the rain and headlights made visibility difficult. Worse still, traffic along the avenue seemed to have stopped. Up ahead, Langdon saw nothing but a line of glowing brake lights.
An event of some sort, the driver announced. A concert, I think. It may be faster on foot.
How far? Sinsky demanded.
Just through the park here. 3 minutes. Very safe.
Sinsky nodded to Bruder and then turned to the SRS team.
Stay in the van. Get as close as you can to the building. Agent Bruder will be in touch very soon.
With that, Sinsky, Bruder, and Langdon jumped out of the van into the street and headed across the park. The broad-leaved trees in Sultan Ahmet Park offered a bit of cover from the worsening weather as the group hurried along its canopied paths. The walkways were dotted with signage directing visitors to the park's many attractions, an Egyptian obelisk from Luxor, the serpent column from the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, and the million column that once served as the point zero from which all distances were measured in the Byzantine Empire. Finally, they emerged from the trees at the foot of a circular reflecting pool that marked the center of the park. Langdon stepped into the opening and raised his eyes to the east. Hagia Sophia. Not so much a building as a mountain. Glistening in the rain, the colossal silhouette of Hagia Sophia appeared to be a city unto itself. Its central dome, impossibly broad and ribbed in silver gray, seemed to rest upon a conglomeration of other domed buildings that had been piled up around it. Four towering minarets, each with a single balcony and a silver gray spire, rose from the corners of the building. So far from the central dome that one could barely determine that they were part of a single structure. Sinsky and Bruder, who until this point had been maintaining a steady, focused jog, both pulled up suddenly, their eyes craning upward, upward, as their minds struggled to absorb the full height and breadth of the structure looming before them. Dear God. Bruder let out a soft groan of disbelief.
We're going to be searching that?
Chapter 86.
I'm being held captive, the provost sensed as he paced the interior of the parked C-130 transport plane.
He had agreed to go to Istanbul to help Sinsky avert this crisis before it went completely out of control. Not lost on the provost was the fact that cooperating with Sinsky might help mitigate any punitive backlash he might suffer for his inadvertent involvement in this crisis. But now Sinsky has me in custody. As soon as the plane had parked inside the government hangar at Ataturk Airport, Sinsky and her team had deplaned, and the head of the WHO ordered the provost and his few consortium staff members to stay aboard. The provost had attempted to step outside for a breath of air, but had been blocked by the stone-faced pilots, who reminded him that Dr. Sinsky had requested that everyone remain aboard. Not good, the provost thought, taking a seat as the uncertainty of his future truly began to settle in. The provost had long been accustomed to being the puppet master, the ultimate force that pulled the strings, and yet suddenly all of his power had been snatched from him. Zobrist, Sienna, Sinsky, they had all defied him
manipulated him even. Now, trapped in the strange windowless holding cell of the WHO's transport jet, he began to wonder if his luck had run out, if his current situation might be a kind of karmic retribution for a lifetime of dishonesty. I lie for a living. I am a purveyor of disinformation. While the provost was not the only one selling lies in this world, he had established himself as the biggest fish in the pond. The smaller fish were a different breed altogether, and the provost disliked even to be associated with them. Available online, businesses with names like the Alibi Company and Alibi Network made fortunes all over the world by providing unfaithful spouses with a way to cheat and not get caught, promising to briefly stop time so their clients could slip away from husband, wife, or kids. These organizations were masters at creating illusions, fake business conventions, fake doctor's appointments, even fake weddings, all of which included phony invitations, brochures, plane tickets, hotel confirmation forms, and even special contact numbers that rang at Alibi Company switchboards, where trained professionals pretended to be whatever receptionist or contact the illusion required. The provost, however, had never wasted his time with such petty artifice. He dealt solely with large-scale deception, plying his trade for those who could afford to pay millions of dollars in order to receive the best service. Governments, major corporations, the occasional ultra-wealthy VIP. To achieve their goals, these clients would have at their disposal all of the consortium's assets, personnel, experience, and creativity. Above all, though, they were given deniability, the assurance that whatever illusion was fabricated in support of their deception could never be traced to them. Whether trying to prop up a stock market, justify a war, win an election, or lure a terrorist out of hiding, the world's power brokers relied on massive disinformation schemes to help shape public perception. It had always been this way. In the 60s, the Russians built an entire fake spy network that dead-dropped bad intel that the British intercepted for years. In 1947, the U.S. Air Force manufactured an elaborate UFO hoax to divert attention from a classified plane crash in Roswell, New Mexico. And more recently, the world had been led to believe that weapons of mass destruction existed in Iraq. For nearly three decades, the provost had helped powerful people protect, retain, and increase their power. Although he was exceptionally careful about the jobs he accepted, the provost had always feared that one day he would take the wrong job. And now that day has arrived. Every epic collapse, the provost believed, could be traced back to a single moment. A chance meeting, a bad decision, an indiscreet glance. In this case, he realized, that instant had come almost a dozen years before, when he agreed to hire a young med school student who was looking for some extra money. The woman's keen intellect, dazzling language skills, and knack for improvisation made her an instantaneous standout at the consortium. Sienna Brooks was a natural. Sienna had immediately understood his operation, and the provost sensed that the young woman was no stranger to keeping secrets herself. Sienna worked for him for almost 2 years, earned a generous paycheck that helped her pay her med school tuition, and then, without warning, she announced that she was done. She wanted to save the world, and as she had told him, she couldn't do it there. The provost never imagined Sienna Brooks would resurface nearly a decade later, bringing with her a gift of sorts, an ultra-wealthy prospective client, Bertrand Zobrist. The provost bristled at the memory. This is Sienna's fault. She was a party to Zobrist's plan all along. Nearby, at the C-130's makeshift conference table, the conversation was becoming heated, with WHO officials talking on phones and arguing. Sienna Brooks? One demanded, shouting into the phone. Are you sure? The official listened a moment, frowning. Okay, get me the details, I'll hold. He covered the receiver and turned to his colleagues. It sounds like Sienna Brooks departed Italy shortly after we did. Everyone at the table stiffened. How? One female employee demanded. We covered the airport, bridges, train station? Nacelli Airfield, he replied, on the Lido. Not possible. the woman countered, shaking her head. Nicelli is tiny. There are no flights out. It handles only local helicopter tours and...
Somehow Sienna Brooks had access to a private jet that was hangared at Nicelli. They're still looking into it. He raised the receiver to his mouth again.
Yes, I'm here. What do you have?
As he listened to the update, his shoulders slumped lower and lower until finally he took a seat.
I understand. Thank you.
He ended the call. His colleagues all stared at him expectantly.
Sienna's jet was headed for Turkey, the man said, rubbing his eyes. Then call European Air Transport Command, someone declared. Have them turn the jet around.
I can't, the man said. It landed 12 minutes ago at Hazarfen Private Airfield, only 15 miles from here. Sienna Brooks is gone.
Chapter 87.
Rain was now pelting the ancient dome of Hagia Sophia. For nearly 1,000 years, it had been the largest church in the world, and even now it was hard to imagine anything larger. Seeing it again, Langdon was reminded that the Emperor Justinian, upon the completion of Hagia Sophia, had stepped back and proudly proclaimed, "Solomon, I have outdone thee." Sinsky and Bruder were marching with intensifying purpose toward the monumental building, which only seemed to swell in size as they approached. The walkways here were lined with the ancient cannonballs used by the forces of Mehmet the Conqueror, a decorative reminder that the history of this building had been filled with violence, as it was conquered and then retasked to serve the spiritual needs of assorted victorious powers. As they neared the southern facade, Langdon glanced to his right at the three domed silo-like appendages jutting off the building. These were the mausoleums of the sultans, one of whom, Murad III, was said to have fathered over 100 children. The ring of a cell phone cut the night air, and Bruder fished his out, checking the caller ID, and answered tersely, "Anything?" As he listened to the report, he shook his head in disbelief. "How is that possible?" He listened further and sighed. "Okay, keep me posted. We're about to go inside." He hung up.
"What is it?" Sinsky demanded.
"Keep your eyes open," Bruder said, glancing around the area. "We may have company." He returned his gaze to Sinsky. "It sounds like Sienna Brooks is in Istanbul." Langdon stared at the man, incredulous to hear both that Sienna had found a way to get to Turkey, and also that, having successfully escaped from Venice, she would risk capture and possible death to ensure that Bertrand Zobrist's plan succeeded. Sinsky looked equally alarmed and drew a breath as if preparing to interrogate Bruder further, but she apparently thought better of it, turning instead to Langdon.
"Which way?"
Langdon pointed to their left around the southwest corner of the building. "The Fountain of Ablutions is over here," he said. Their rendezvous point with the museum contact was an ornately latticed wellhead that had once been used for ritual washing before Muslim prayer.
"Professor Langdon,"
a man's voice shouted as they drew near. A smiling Turkish man stepped out from under the octagonal cupola that covered the fountain. He was waving his arms excitedly.
"Professor, over here."
Langdon and the others hurried over.
"Hello. My name is Mirsat,"
he said, his accented English voice brimming with enthusiasm. He was a slight man with thinning hair, scholarly-looking glasses, and a gray suit.
"This is a great honor for me."
"The honor is ours," Langdon replied, shaking Mirsat's hand. "Thank you for your hospitality on such short notice."
"Yes, yes. I'm Elizabeth Sinsky,"
Dr. Sinsky said, shaking Mirsat's hand and then motioning to Bruder.
"And this is Christoph Bruder. We're here to assist, Professor Langdon. I'm so sorry our plane was delayed. You're very kind to accommodate us."
"Please think nothing of it," Mirsat gushed. "For Professor Langdon, I would give a private tour at any hour. His little book, Christian Symbols in the Muslim World, is a favorite in our museum gift shop."
"Really?" Langdon thought. "Now I know the one place on Earth that carries that book."
"Shall we?"
Mirsat said, motioning for them to follow. The group hurried across a small open space, passing the regular tourist entrance and continuing on to what had originally been the building's main entrance, three deeply recessed archways with massive bronze doors. Two armed security guards were waiting to greet them. Upon seeing Mirsat, The guards unlocked one of the doors and swung it open.
Saulun, Mirsat said, uttering one of a handful of Turkish phrases Langdon was familiar with, an especially polite form of thank you.
The group stepped through, and the guards closed the heavy doors behind them, the thud resonating through the stone interior. Langdon and the others were now standing in Hagia Sophia's narthex, a narrow antechamber that was common in Christian churches and served as an architectural buffer between the divine and the profane. Spiritual moats, Langdon often called them. The group crossed toward another set of doors, and Mirsat pulled one open. Beyond it, instead of the sanctuary he had anticipated seeing, Langdon beheld a secondary narthex, slightly larger than the first. An Esso narthex, Langdon realized, having forgotten that Hagia Sophia's sanctuary enjoyed two levels of protection from the outside world. As if to prepare the visitor for what lay ahead, the Esso narthex was significantly more ornate than the narthex, its walls made of burnished stone that glowed in the light of elegant chandeliers. On the far side of the serene space stood four doors, above which were spectacular mosaics, which Langdon found himself intently admiring. Mirsat walked to the largest door, a colossal bronze-plated portal.
"The imperial doorway,"
Mirsat whispered, his voice almost giddy with enthusiasm.
"In Byzantine times, this door was reserved for sole use of the emperor. Tourists don't usually go through it, but this is a special night."
Mirsat reached for the door, but paused.
"Before we enter," he whispered, "let me ask, is there something in particular you would like to see inside?"
Langdon, Sinsky, and Bruder all glanced at one another.
"Yes," Langdon said. "There's so much to see, of course, but if we could, we'd like to begin with the tomb of Enrico Dandolo."
Mirsat cocked his head as if he had misunderstood.
"I'm sorry? You want to see Dandolo's tomb?"
"We do."
Mirsat looked downcast.
"But, sir, Dandolo's tomb is very plain. No symbols at all. Not our finest offering."
"I realize that," Langdon said politely. "All the same, we'd be most grateful if you could take us to it." Mirsat studied Langdon a long moment, and then his eyes drifted upward to the mosaic directly over the door, which Langdon had just been admiring. The mosaic was a 9th-century image of the Pantocrator Christ, the iconic image of Christ holding the New Testament in his left hand while making a blessing with his right. Then, as if a light had suddenly dawned for their guide, the corners of Mirsat's lips curled into a knowing smile, and he began wagging his finger.
"Clever man, very clever."
Langdon stared. "I'm sorry?"
"Don't worry, Professor," Mirsat said in a conspiratorial whisper. "I won't tell anyone why you're really here."
Sinsky and Bruder shot Langdon a puzzled look. All Langdon could do was shrug as Mirsat heaved open the door and ushered them inside. Chapter 88. The eighth wonder of the world, some had called this space, and standing in it now, Langdon was not about to argue with that assessment. As the group stepped across the threshold into the colossal sanctuary, Langdon was reminded that Hagia Sophia required only an instant to impress upon its visitors the sheer magnitude of its proportions. So vast was this room that it seemed to dwarf even the great cathedrals of Europe. The staggering force of its enormity was, Langdon knew, partly an illusion, a dramatic side effect of its Byzantine floor plan, with a centralized naos that concentrated all of its interior space in a single square room rather than extending it along the four arms of a cruciform, as was the style adopted in later cathedrals.
"This building is 700 years older than Notre Dame," Langdon thought.
After taking a moment to absorb the breadth of the room's dimensions, Langdon let his eyes climb skyward more than 150 feet overhead to the sprawling golden dome that crowned the room. From its central point, 40 ribs radiated outward like rays of the sun, extending to a circular arcade of 40 arched windows. During daylight hours, the light that streamed through these windows reflected and re-reflected off glass shards embedded in the golden tilework, creating the mystical light for which Hagia Sophia was most famous. Langdon had seen the gilded ambience of this room captured accurately in painting, only once, John Singer Sargent. Not surprisingly, in creating his famous painting of Hagia Sophia, the American artist had limited his palette only to multiple shades of a single color, gold. The glistening golden cupola was often called the Dome of Heaven itself, and was supported by four tremendous arches, which in turn were sustained by a series of semi-domes and tympana. These supports were then carried by yet another descending tier of smaller semi-domes and arcades, creating the effect of a cascade of architectural forms working their way from heaven toward earth. Moving from heaven to earth, albeit by a more direct route, long cables descended straight down from the dome and supported a sea of gleaming chandeliers, which seemed to hang so low to the floor that tall visitors risked colliding with them. In reality, this was another illusion created by the sheer magnitude of the space, for the fixtures hung more than 12 feet off the floor. As with all great shrines, Hagia Sophia's prodigious size served two purposes. First, it was proof to God of the great lengths to which man would go to pay tribute to him. And second, it served as a kind of shock treatment for worshippers, a physical space so imposing that those who entered felt dwarfed, their egos erased, their physical being and cosmic importance shrinking to the size of a mere speck in the face of God, an atom in the hands of the Creator. Until a man is nothing, God can make nothing out of him. Martin Luther had spoken those words in the 16th century, but the concept had been part of the mindset of builders since the earliest examples of religious architecture. Langdon glanced over at Bruder and Sinsky, who had been staring upward and who now lowered their eyes to earth.
Jesus, Bruder said.
Yes, Mirsat said excitedly, and Allah and Muhammad too.
Langdon chuckled as their guide directed Bruder's gaze to the main altar, where a towering mosaic of Jesus was flanked by two massive discs bearing the Arabic names of Muhammad and Allah in ornate calligraphy.
This museum, Mirsat explained, in an effort to remind visitors of the diverse uses of this sacred space, displays in tandem both the Christian iconography from the days when Hagia Sophia was a basilica and the Islamic iconography from its days as a mosque. He gave a proud smile. Despite the friction between the religions in the real world, we think their symbols work quite nicely together. I know you agree, Professor.
Langdon gave a heartfelt nod, recalling that all of the Christian iconography had been covered in whitewash when the building became a mosque. The restoration of the Christian symbols next to the Muslim symbols had created a mesmerizing effect, particularly because the styles and sensibilities of the two iconographies are polar opposites. While Christian tradition favored literal images of its gods and saints, Islam focused on calligraphy and geometric patterns to represent the beauty of God's universe. Islamic tradition held that only God could create life, and therefore man has no place creating images of life, not gods, not people, not even animals. Langdon recalled once trying to explain this concept to his students. A Muslim Michelangelo, for example, would never have painted God's face on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. He would have inscribed the name of God. Depicting God's face would be considered blasphemy. Langdon had gone on to explain the reason for this. Both Christianity and Islam are logocentric, he told his students, meaning they are focused on the Word. In Christian tradition, the Word became flesh in the book of John. And the Word was made flesh, and he dwelt among us. Therefore, it was acceptable to depict the Word as having a human form. In Islamic tradition, however, the Word did not become flesh, and therefore the Word needs to remain in the form of a word. In most cases, calligraphic renderings of the names of the holy figures of Islam. One of Langdon's students had summed up the complex history with an amusingly accurate marginal note. Christians like faces, Muslims like words.
Here before us, Mirsat went on, motioning across the spectacular room, you see a unique blending of Christianity with Islam.
He quickly pointed out the fusion of symbols in the massive apse, most notably the Virgin and Child gazing down upon a mihrab, the semicircular niche in a mosque that indicates the direction of Mecca.
Nearby, a staircase rose up to an orator's pulpit, which resembled the kind from which Christian sermons are delivered, but in fact was a minbar, the holy platform from which an imam leads Friday services. Similarly, the dais-like structure nearby resembled a Christian choir stall, but in reality was a muezzin mahfili, a raised platform where a muezzin kneels and chants in response to the imam's prayers.
Mosques and cathedrals are startlingly similar, Mirsat proclaimed. The traditions of East and West are not as divergent as you might think.
Mirsat, Bruder pressed, sounding impatient. We'd really like to see Dandolo's tomb, if we may.
Mirsat looked mildly annoyed, as if the man's haste were somehow a display of disrespect to the building.
Yes, Langdon said. I'm sorry to rush, but we're on a very tight schedule.
Very well, then,
Mirsat said, pointing to a high balcony to their right.
Let's head upstairs and see the tomb.
Up, Langdon replied, startled. Isn't Enrico Dandolo buried down in the crypt?
Langdon recalled the tomb itself, but not the precise place in the building where it was located. He had been picturing the dark underground areas of the building. Mirsat seemed confounded by the query.
No, Professor. The tomb of Enrico Dandolo is most certainly upstairs.
What the devil is going on here? Mirsat wondered. When Langdon had asked to see Dandolo's tomb, Mirsat had sensed that the request was a kind of decoy.
Nobody wants to see Dandolo's tomb.
Mirsat had assumed what Langdon really wanted to see was the enigmatic treasure directly beside Dandolo's tomb. The Deesis mosaic, an ancient pantocrator Christ that was arguably one of the most mysterious pieces of art in the building.
Langdon is researching the mosaic and trying to be discreet about it,
Mirsat had guessed, imagining that the professor was probably writing a secret piece on the Deesis. Now, however, Mirsat was confused. Certainly Langdon knew the Deesis mosaic was on the second floor, so why was he acting so surprised?
Unless he is indeed looking for Dandolo's tomb.
Puzzled, Mirsat guided them toward the staircase, passing one of Hagia Sophia's two famous urns, a 330-gallon behemoth carved out of a single piece of marble during the Hellenistic period. Climbing in silence now with his entourage, Mirsat found himself feeling unsettled. Langdon's colleagues did not seem like academics at all. One of them looked like a soldier of some sort, muscular and rigid, dressed all in black. And the woman with the silver hair. Mirsat sensed he had seen her before. Maybe on television? He was starting to suspect that the purpose of this visit was not what it appeared to be.
Why are they really here?
One more flight, Mirsat announced cheerily as they reached the landing. Upstairs, we shall find the tomb of Enrico Dandolo, and of course,
he paused, eyeing Langdon,
the famed Deesis mosaic.
Not even a flinch. Langdon, it appeared, was not, in fact, here for the Deesis mosaic at all. He and his guests seemed inexplicably fixated on Dandolo's tomb.
Chapter 89. As Mirsat led the way up the stairs, Langdon could tell that Bruder and Sinsky were worried. Admittedly, ascending to the second floor seemed to make no sense. Langdon kept picturing Zobrist's subterranean video and the documentary film about the submerged areas beneath Hagia Sophia.
We need to go down.
Even so, if this was the location of Dandolo's tomb, they had no choice but to follow Zobrist's directions. Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom, and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water. When they finally reached the second level, Mirsat led them to the right, along the balcony's edge, which offered breathtaking views of the sanctuary below. Langdon faced front, remaining focused. Mirsat was talking fervently about the Deesis mosaic again, but Langdon tuned him out. He could now see his target. Dandolo's tomb. The tomb appeared exactly as Langdon remembered it, a rectangular piece of white marble inlaid in the polished stone floor and cordoned off by stanchions and chains. Langdon rushed over and examined the carved inscription. Henricus Dandolo.
As the others arrived behind him, Langdon sprang into action, stepping over the protective chain and placing his feet directly in front of the tombstone. Mirsat protested loudly, but Langdon continued, dropping quickly to his knees, as if preparing to pray at the feet of the treacherous Doje. Next, in a move that elicited shouts of horror from Mirsat, Langdon placed his palms flat on the tomb and prostrated himself. As he lowered his face to the ground, Langdon realized that he looked like he was bowing to Mecca. The maneuver apparently stunned Mirsat, who fell mute, and a sudden hush seemed to pervade the entire building. Taking a deep breath, Langdon turned his head to the right and gently pressed his left ear to the tomb. The stone felt cold on his flesh. The sound he heard echoing up through the stone was as clear as day. My God! The finale of Dante's Inferno seemed to be echoing up from below. Slowly, Langdon turned his head, gazing up at Bruder and Sinsky. I hear it, he whispered. The sounds of trickling water. Bruder vaulted the chain and crouched down beside Langdon to listen. After a moment, he was nodding intently. Now that they could hear the water flowing downward, one question remained. Where is it flowing? Langdon's mind was suddenly flooded with images of a half-submerged cavern, bathed in an eerie red light, somewhere beneath them. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here in the darkness the thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars. When Langdon stood and stepped back over the stanchions, Mirsat was glaring up at him with a look of alarm and betrayal on his face. Langdon stood almost a foot taller than the Turkish guide. Mirsat, Langdon began, I'm sorry. As you can see, this is a very unusual situation. I don't have time to explain, but I have a very important question to ask you about this building. Mirsat managed a weak nod.
Okay.
Here at Dandolo's tomb, we can hear a rivulet of water flowing somewhere under the stone. We need to know where this water flows. Mirsat shook his head.
I don't understand. Water can be heard beneath the floors everywhere in Hagia Sophia.
Everyone stiffened.
Yes, Mirsat told them, especially when it rains. Hagia Sophia has approximately 100,000 square feet of rooftops that need to drain, and it often takes days. And usually it rains again before the drainage is complete. The sounds of trickling water are quite common here. Perhaps you are aware that Hagia Sophia sits on vast caverns of water. There was a documentary, even, which...
Yes, yes, Langdon said, but do you know if the water that is audible here at Dandolo's tomb flows somewhere specific?
Of course, Mirsat said. It flows to the same place that all the water shedding from Hagia Sophia flows, to the city cistern.
No, Bruder declared, stepping back over the stanchion. We are not looking for a cistern. We are looking for a large underground space, perhaps with columns?
Yes, Mirsat said. The city's ancient cistern is precisely that. A large underground space with columns. Quite impressive, actually. It was built in the 6th century to house the city's water supply. Nowadays it contains only about 4 feet of water, but...
Where is it?
Bruder demanded, his voice echoing across the empty hall.
The cistern?
Mirsat asked, looking frightened.
It's a block away, just east of this building.
He pointed outside.
It's called Yerbatan Sarayi.
Sarayi? Langdon wondered. As in Topkapi Sarayi? Signage for the Topkapi Palace had been ubiquitous as they were driving in. But doesn't Sarayi mean palace? Mirsat nodded.
Yes. The name of our ancient cistern is Yerbatan Sarayi. It means the sunken palace.
Chapter 90. The rain was falling in sheets as Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky burst out of Hagia Sophia with Langdon, Bruder, and their bewildered guide, Mirsat.
Follow deep into the sunken palace, Sinsky thought.
The site of the city's cistern, Yerbatan Sarayi, was apparently back toward the Blue Mosque and a bit to the north. Mirsat led the way. Sinsky had seen no other option but to tell Mirsat who they were and that they were racing to thwart a possible health crisis within the sunken palace.
This way!
Mirsat called, leading them across the darkened park, The mountain of Hagia Sophia was behind them now, and the fairy tale spires of the Blue Mosque glistened ahead. Hurrying beside Sinsky, Agent Bruder was shouting into his phone, updating the SRS team and ordering them to rendezvous at the cistern's entrance.
"It sounds like Zobrist is targeting the city's water supply," Bruder said, breathless. "I'm going to need schematics of all conduits in and out of the cistern. We'll run full isolation and containment protocols. We'll need physical and chemical barriers along with vacuum."
"Wait," Mirsat called over to him. "You misunderstood me. The cistern is not the city water supply. Not anymore."
Bruder lowered his phone, glaring at their guide.
"What?"
"In ancient times, the cistern held the water supply," Mirsat clarified. "But no longer. We modernized."
Bruder came to a stop under a sheltering tree, and everyone halted with him.
"Mirsat," Sinsky said, "you're sure that nobody drinks the water out of the cistern?"
"Heavens no," Mirsat said. "The water pretty much just sits there, eventually filtering down into the earth."
Sinsky, Langdon, and Bruder all exchanged uncertain looks. Sinsky didn't know whether to feel relieved or alarmed.
"If nobody comes in regular contact with the water, why would Zobrist choose to contaminate it?" "When we modernized our water supply decades ago," Mirsat explained, "the cistern fell out of use and became just a big pond in an underground room."
He shrugged.
"These days it's nothing more than a tourist attraction."
Sinsky spun toward Mirsat.
"A tourist attraction?
Hold on. People can go down there? Into the cistern?" "Of course," he said. "Many thousands visit every day. The cavern is quite striking. There are boardwalks over the water and even a small cafe. There's limited ventilation, so the air is quite stuffy and humid, but it's still very popular."
Sinsky's eyes locked on Bruder, and she could tell that she and the trained SRS agent were picturing the same thing. A dark, humid cavern filled with stagnant water in which a pathogen was incubating. Completing the nightmare was the presence of boardwalks over which tourists moved all day long, just above the water's surface.
"He's created a bioaerosol," Bruder declared.
Sinsky nodded, slumping.
"Meaning?" Langdon demanded. "Meaning," Bruder replied, "that it can go airborne."
Langdon fell silent, and Sinsky could see that he was now grasping the potential magnitude of this crisis. An airborne pathogen had been on Sinsky's mind as a possible scenario for some time, and yet when she believed that the cistern was the city's water supply, she had hoped maybe this meant that Zobrist had chosen a water-bound bioform. Water-dwelling bacteria were robust and weather-resistant, but they were also slow to propagate. Airborne pathogens spread fast, very fast.
"If it's airborne," Bruder said, "it's probably viral."
"A virus," Sinsky agreed. "The fastest-spreading pathogen Zobrist could choose."